I'm so excited to share more about our headline sponsor, Stocker. I've been getting to know the company behind the amazing products, and I'm just so blown away by how the company operates. It was founded in 1932, but it was in 1972 that the now famous trip-trap chair was released. You know the one, it's wooden and it's almost looks in a Z shape. It was completely groundbreaking because it allowed children to eat at eye level with the adults, and it actually revolutionized children's seating. And don't you just think it's fascinating that the design and concept is just as relevant now as it was back then? And I guess that's the sign of true timeless design, isn't it? I just love how the chair grows with your children. So my eldest has used it every day from 6 months to today, and she's eight, which not only makes it brilliant value, but I actually can't believe how well it's worn. It still looks pretty new, and that makes it really sustainable too. So over the coming months, I'm going to be telling you lots more about Stocker and their amazing products. So please do go and check out stocker.com. That's stocker.com. I'm delighted to introduce this week's podcast sponsor, barefoot footwear company, Vivo Barefoot. Did you know that 90% of kids are wearing shoes that are too small, which prevents their normal, natural growth? And Vivo Barefoot shoes keep feet as barefoot as possible, because that is the best way to ensure feet stay naturally strong and healthy. They actually increase foot strength and stability by up to 60%. I have known about them for years because my husband Guy is a big fan, but now I'm super excited because they've just launched their first ever walker for toddlers and preschoolers. The shoe is called Pluma, meaning feather, and it's lightweight, flexible, and so soft and snug that actually socks aren't needed. So it is the perfect transition from barefoot to footwear. Now, Vivo Barefoot are offering Motherkind podcast listeners a 10% discount. So use the code MotherkindVB on their website to take advantage of this fantastic offer. That is Vivo Barefoot website, and use the code MotherkindVB. Back to the episode. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Motherkind podcast. It is me, your host, Zoe Blasky. I'm so happy you're here. This is the show that is guaranteed to give you more confidence, connection, and empowerment in the wild ride that is modern motherhood. I've got an incredible guest for you this week. Her name is Kelechi Okafor. She is a Black British actress, author, director, and public speaker. She is incredible. Jamelia Jamal called her one of the most important voices of our generation, and I think you'll see why after listening to this episode. When you hear the phrase, you need to put yourself first to be the mother you want to be, what comes up for you? If that feels uncomfortable or triggering, or you're thinking that's not right, that's selfish, then you are listening to the right episode, because Kelechi breaks down for us why we find it so hard to meet our own needs in motherhood and how we can change that. We dive into all the good stuff, breaking generational patterns, reconnecting with our younger selves, finding more joy in motherhood and life, and why we've been sold a big fat lie about rest and productivity and what to do about it. You are going to love this episode. And before we dive into it, quick favor, you would have discovered this podcast by someone sharing it with you. You might have discovered it on Instagram, someone told you about it, it might have been put into a WhatsApp group that you're on. So can you pay it forward? If someone shared it with you, can you share it with someone today? Tell someone about it, share a link in your mum WhatsApp group, or pop it on your social media, because I know it's only together that we are going to reach every mother who deserves to hear these empowering conversations. Here it is. Oh, well, Kelechi, welcome. I discovered you online recently, and then I listened to that podcast that you did on iWay, and I just loved it. And Jamelia said, this is one of the most important voices of our generation. And I was like, I've got to get this woman on. So I'm very, very excited that you're here. And especially, we were just saying to talk about motherhood, and this is, you know, a safe space to do that. And so I'm so excited to dive into that with you. And I wanted to ask you first about something that I heard you say on a podcast in 2020.
And it gave me goosebumps because it felt so true for me and the opposite of what we've been taught. And you said, motherhood has made me see there is no one more important in this equation than me.
I think because I kept reading. I love to research. I love to learn things. And everywhere I was looking, you'd see things, especially during like pregnancy and things like that. They'd say stuff like, oh, and this happens in the 28th week. We don't know why. And then this happens in the 32nd, and we don't know why. So I just thought, okay, so we are undergoing, experiencing, navigating this realm that a lot of people don't know anything about. And I think that that's a result of patriarchy as well, just not adding the funding to research into these things. And also because I feel like there is a mystical aspect to pregnancy, for instance, that is meant to be unknown. And that is part of just like the miracle of what it is. There's the science and then there's the miracle and they intermingle. But I did start to think, so if people don't know what's going on, it's really, really important that I, for myself, know what's going on with me. And then I started thinking about that even more so after having my son, that a lot of people don't know what's like. They talk about every pregnancy is different, every child is different, every mother is different. So I really started to eschew any narrative that was just like, as a mother, you should do this. And I saw so many images of this smiling mum and smiling pregnant person. And I just thought, I didn't really enjoy pregnancies, but I don't see much talked about in that regard. So I really had to start focusing on the fact that this experience is about me. I need to know how I feel and not use other people as a benchmark for where I should be. Of course, you can see what somebody else is doing over there and be like, you know what, that's sick. I think I'll implement that. But that person is not like the be all and end all of what it means to be a mother. I started reading a lot about, you know, the myth of mother and how, because of patriarchy, motherhood is presented to us in such a way that essentially it's unpaid labor that requires such sacrifice that the mothers end up being empty shells of themselves. And then you get, you know, mothers that say things like, I gave up my such and such for you, and I gave up this, and I feel like usually that's said as a way of, look how much I love you, I gave up these things. But really what should be processed is the fact that you shouldn't have had to do any of that, because what I'm hearing is resentment. And I wouldn't want to be the kind of mother that turns to my son in years to come and I say, I didn't da 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 because of you. Because why didn't you? Nobody was holding you. Like there are ways and means to still ensure that you live a fulfilled life. Whereas I think it's been packaged to us throughout the centuries that this is our only calling. Once you are a mother, that is it. Your life ends there. Your life ends there. You then become this, you know, rehabilitation center, this, you know, this one-stop shop for everything that everybody else needs around you. And so then what was the point of being here in the first place if you were only got to live, I don't know, 21 years of life, if that, because after that point, you started being for everybody else.
It's so my experience as well through, you know, lots of similar reading that you did. And there's this phrase that I just latch onto, which is model, not martyr.
Absolutely. And I think especially having done a lot of social justice, social commentary and things prior to having my son, even that was a whole journey of extrapolating why am I doing this? Because again, this is not a case of martyrdom. So if I don't want to be a martyr for the people, why do I want to be a martyr when it's in, you know, my personal, like my day-to-day life? Because there is an ego there. And I think that motherhood has really taught me a lot about ego. Sometimes we want to assert an authority or dominance that we don't really have a right to. And it's because in the back of our minds, what's really playing there is, but I've had to do this and I endured this. So I feel entitled to this particular thing or this particular type of behavior. And so it's about replaying it and going back and fixing those things and not making it something that's been projected onto the child.
And I think you said this in an article that you wrote, that children are pathways to your own healing. And that has absolutely been my experience. Like something I still get tripped up on, right, is we'll be going for a family dinner or a dinner where there's kind of a need to behave a certain way. And I find it so hard not to say to my girls that 8 and 4, please, can you just sit at the table? Please, can you just not scream? Because that's my issue. It's my insecurity. I want people to think I'm a quote unquote good mother because I've got these well-behaved children. And I've really had to untangle that narrative. Like, why is good sitting still?
That is it. That sense of conformity. And because we feel the innate fear of how we've been conditioned to know that when we don't conform, there is a danger that comes with that, because then we are seen. And you know, that you're always told, you know, even in school, like, don't get attention drawn to yourself for the wrong reasons and things like that. So we become really, really worried about having attention drawn to ourselves for the quote unquote wrong reasons. And I'm, you know, I feel you on that. And I think that as a Black mother, when I think about my son, you know, being, you know, boisterous and doing what he's doing and full of energy and doing those things, especially when we are in spaces where maybe there aren't many other Black people, instantly I feel more of a thing of like, okay, you need to behave because they already have a perception of what Black mothers are like. You need to behave. And I had to check myself and I was like, no, you can do what you want, because the other children are running around, or if they're not running around, that's their personal problem. Again, like, everybody is raised differently. So recently we went to Lisbon for New Year's. And so it was just the two of us and we went out for lunch, and he was really particular that, you know, the custard pastries.
Oh,
yeah.
Of course I know the custard pastries.
And he was like, I want to eat it now. I said, no, we'll eat it when we get back to the apartment. We'll eat it then. For now though, we're going to have lunch at this place, like the seafood place. We'll eat here and then we'll take the pastries back and we'll have them there. He was very particular that I want my thing now. And there were people sitting next to us and they kept looking over at him because he was just, you know, being very, very particular, very vocal that he wanted this thing. And meanwhile, I was sort of chilled because I've already said what I'm saying, which is, we're not eating it now. So if you want to shout for a little bit, you shout for a little bit, but that, it's done. But I felt like I couldn't follow the process through because people kept looking over and then doing that weird thing where they were like, little boy, listen to your mum. Listen. It's like, wait. When did this become a group project? Why are you having any input? And again, noticing that I was feeling a frustration and thinking to myself, well, if you weren't shouting, they wouldn't feel the need to be in our conversation right now. And then instantly having to say, Kelechi, that's a you problem, right? Just leave it as what it is. And so I think we get that we might be more chilled if it wasn't for the fact that society already is looking at us as, oh, but aren't you a mother? So why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you quote unquote mothering? But what if the mothering is already taking place right now in this moment? Because first I mother myself when I feel like that's what it is for me. Sometimes situations happen and the instinct is to go to, you know, in quotation marks, mother the child, when actually it's yourself that needs to be mothered in that moment. So not projecting outwards what the work that needs to be done inwards.
What are some of the big ways you've had to mother yourself through motherhood?
Allowing space for joy, you know, allowing space for joy, allowing space for play. I think that that's been really, really important. Noting that I've always been somebody that really enjoys me time. Like, I like my space. I like to just chill. And I know that with a lot of aspects of motherhood, that time becomes very small, becomes very limited. And so I had to make the, you know, concerted effort, be very intentional about saying, you know, put things in place, whether it's my mom or, you know, some kind of support network, you watch him because I'm off to go and do whatever it is I want to do, whether that's straps, whether that's Brazilian jiu-jitsu, or whether it's going for a run or whatever the case may be. Because I remember when I was growing up, and I think that these are patterns that repeat themselves, especially if you've had a particular type of upbringing. So I remember a specific memory where I said to my mom, oh, my friends are going to the cinema. And she was just like, yeah, but then who's going to watch your brothers? And that was when I was maybe like 12. So there's been this thing of whatever you want to do, that's on the back burner. you have a responsibility for your younger siblings or whoever's younger or whoever needs you, even if there isn't a difference in age, whoever needs you, that becomes your priority. So a major component of knowing joy and experiencing joy was for me to backtrack and think of all the things that I wanted to do, but was told I could not do because other people essentially were more important than what I wanted to do for myself.
I'm fascinated by that cycle that you've broken around. It sounds like you were very responsible, very young. And when you first started to break that cycle and think, actually, no, I'm allowed to put my needs first, what resistance did you come up against and how did you break that? Because that is what I see mothers struggling with.
One of the misconceptions is that it's a one and done. Like you do it once and then that's it. Like, oh yeah, that's it. I've asserted my boundaries once. I've put myself first once and that means I'll continue to. No, I think that in little ways, things show up. You know, I even have it now. I've got a nanny for my son. And so sometimes she picks him up from nursery when I can't because I'm working. And so he'll say things like, oh, I'm just so sad that you won't pick me up. And I'm like, I understand that you're sad. And this is why I have somebody wonderful who's picking you up in my place, because I'm going to go off and do some things and I'll be right back when I'm done. You know, and then, but there will still be that like tinge or like the twinge of like, oh, but, you know, it's teaching, you know, children from a young age that your mum is a whole person outside of you. This is a whole ass person that has their own life and you are a part of their life and they're a part of yours. And it's understanding that, you know, because people will say, oh, you know, my child or my children are my life. While I get the sentiment, they're a part of your life. They shouldn't be your life because there's a sense of overwhelm and enmeshment that I usually hear in that as well. And so this was, when you ask about this process, it's been a long process. You know, when I was living with my mum, I remember I was training for like half marathons and things like that. So I'd be very particular about buying bottles of water and keeping it in my room. And I would come back sometimes from work and then see that bottles of water were just gone, like bottles taken out. And I'd think, well, we're all adults. Why did somebody go and help themselves to my water? Yeah, but you bought it and, you know, we didn't have any water downstairs in the kitchen and it just saved somebody having to go to the supermarket. So I had to, again, start thinking in those instances, no, these are my boundaries. Don't do that. And so it's been a gradual process. I remember saying, because I think that it's a long-standing pattern. And this is why I'm so proud of where I am now, because from a very young age, I was responsible for my brothers and in essence, in some parts for my mum as well as for myself. So, you know, being that parentified child. And I would often say that I had to kind of learn how to cook rice and do these things from about the age of 8. I already knew how to do certain things and clean up and do this and do that, because it needed to be done. And if I didn't do it, how was it going to get done? Well, an adult should have done that, but the adults weren't really adulting. So I had to learn how to do that. So, you know, those things, and even till today, feeling rather, you know, responsible for my brothers in that sense, but it's a gradual process that you sort of break away from. You take care of other people, hoping that they get better enough or robust enough to one day turn to you and go, oh, you need taken care of too. And the likelihood is that that won't happen. That doesn't happen. So instead of pushing all of that energy outwards, it was really about bringing it to myself and thinking about all of the things I needed, and not just needed, but also wanted.
What other cycles are you breaking?
I would probably say one that requires visibility, hence, you know, coming off social media at the end of the month and, you know, leaving my page there, but just not engaging with it in the same way. Because again, that desire to, you know, growing up, having been through things as a child and thinking of that, about the world as a very unsafe place, growing into the kind of woman that wants to point out that we need to do better to make the world a safer place, and saying all of these things and doing all of these things and realizing that I think I've done enough for now. there is such a thing as having done enough. I feel seen, I feel appreciated when I'm holding everything together and doing things for everybody. And so while I feel that in the personal sense, I was dealing with that, in the professional sense, I was still exhibiting the same patterns of behavior, that I'm praised and I'm looked upon for holding things together or bringing things together and highlighting things and showing how efficient I can be. And everybody coming onto the page, you know, whether it's Twitter or Instagram, saying, well done. Thank you. Without you, what would we do? Well done for point. That can become very addictive. And so it's important at some point to say, I think I've done enough.
Because we've been taught, you know, your path to that inner joy that you were describing is doing the opposite, is more success, doing more, running more, never stopping. And so to do the opposite is revolutionary.
All revolutions, I think, are scary. You know, at the beginning, it again allows me to spend time with my inner child and really, you know, experience what joy feels like. Because there is something about coming online, making a video and talking about the things that are happening in the world and then leaving yourself open to any manner of horrible, horrible comments that could come, you know, come your way. And having experienced that for a number of years, it's just not good energy. So it's nice to be able to say, this is enough. Everybody else enjoy it that wants to be here. I'm off to go and do other things. And again, it's that fear of being forgotten. It's the same when we are growing up in the households that we grow up in when we're children. If I don't do this, I might not stand out. Social media has us thinking about things, especially even dating apps that people are on and things like that. The nature of patriarchy is that if you don't perform as a good woman, you will be forgotten. What are we told usually? You're going to get left on the shelf and you're going to die. You're going to die alone. It's been there the whole time, a fear of being forgotten. So, but what if you choose that? Forget me if you want. That's fine. I'm out. Because if anybody, the biggest risk is that I forget myself. Not that you forget me, because who gives a damn? But if I forget myself, then that's it. Then there was no point really in having had this human experience.
This episode is sponsored by Cricut. Now, if you follow me on social media, you will have seen that to get me off my phone in the evenings, I've started crafting and I love it. What has totally changed the game for me is getting a Cricut machine, which is technically a smart cutting machine. But what it really is creating stickers for the girls, personalizing everything in sight, and even making my own birthday cards. There is so much you can do. Now, let's be clear. I am not a natural crafter, but Cricut has a free design space app which has thousands of ready-to-make projects and tens of thousands of images with step-by-step instructions. The other day, my eldest wanted to put her favorite animal, which is a tiger, on the front of her notebook. So we just searched for an image she loved, created a vinyl sticker on the Cricut, and done. Cricut are running a big sales event until the 10th of April. So now is the time to get one. Just go to cricut.com. That's C-R-I-C-U-T.com. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stresses, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. And therapy is a space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. Therapy is just an incredible, safe, non-judgmental space. I absolutely love it. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which I think as busy mums is what we all need. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/motherkind today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/motherkind.
When you can start giving yourself a little bit of validation, even, you know, for someone listening to this in a tiny way, like, I've done enough today. I'm just going to sit and have a cup of tea before the school run. instead of running around more. It's these tiny 1% that can start that shift, isn't it?
And that's what we need. It's a muscle. You have to train it. So as somebody that's been a personal trainer for a number of years, like you have anything that you start, it's a process. And then the muscle starts to remember that, oh, this is what you want to do. Okay, cool. And so I think that that's the same thing with compassion, self-compassion. We have to train it, and we can only show true compassion to other people if we've felt it ourselves. Like I can't sell you something that I haven't even tried for myself, you know? And growing up in a Nigerian household, there was always this thing where you heard the key in the door and you jump up because you're like, oh my God, have I done everything? Have I done everything that I needed to do? Or you're chilling out, watching cartoons or whatever, just watching the daytime TV shows at the weekend. Your mum comes in. So is this what we're doing today? We're just hanging out. Nobody wants to go and Hoover. Nobody wants to go and clean the gut. And you're like, what? But then we get used to that and thinking that rest is unproductive, whereas rest is one of the most productive things that you can do. If you're talking about just having that space in life, there has to be space for rest. And even outside of it being the most quote unquote productive thing you can do, you should just rest because you want to.
How do you choose then what you do? Because you're going to the Black Maternal Health Conference in March. You've got your picture book out. How are you making those choices now about what you want to put your energy, your precious energy behind?
There comes a point where you can't think with your head anymore. Because if you imagine that your brain, our brains have been conditioned, even before we were born, we were already being programmed to be a particular way. So we came straight out into a particular set of clothes, into a particular set of like Goo Goo Gagas. Like it was, everything was already set up. Like our brain absorbs that, looks like a sponge. It absorbs all of that. So the brain can't really be relied upon for what we do next. But the body still remembers, like the body still knows, right? So does this thing excite me? Do I want to write a picture book? Yes. Oh, excitement. No, no excitement. Okay, that means I want to do a picture book. So that's what I'm going to do. When I opened my pole dance studio, that happened because I thought there needs to be more diversity. There needs to be more happening in the fitness industry. And again, thinking about conforming, being a good girl, being a good woman, being a good mother, that's a brain thing. That's not a body thing. Because if you checked in with your body's probably like, I'm tired. I don't even want to do no Black Maternal. Whereas I'm thinking, I'm excited. I absolutely want to be at this convention. I absolutely want to be at this conference. I want to speak. I absolutely want to do this picture book.
I love this thing that someone taught me, gosh, about 2 decades ago, which was focus on how it feels over how it looks. And it's so simple, but actually there's just a ton of unlearning that needs to happen in that. Because I used to make decisions, like when I chose my degree, I was like, genuinely, like, this makes me look really smart. I did economics. This makes me look really smart. It never felt good. Mm-hmm. I hated it. But I was like, it makes me look smart, right? Because I couldn't validate myself. So I had to get it from outside. What feels really exciting to you about that conference? I love that conference. Let's talk about it. What feels exciting to you about the Black Maternal Health Conference in March?
I think what feels exciting about it is that we are demanding change now. You know, for so long as mothers across the board, we've just kind of accepted, like I said, oh, we don't know why that happens. Sorry. Like we've kind of accepted things as, oh, that's just the way it is. And we're being told that this is just the way it is by people who are smarter than us. So whether we're looking at healthcare or we're looking at politics as a whole, we have kind of given away our autonomy, our power, because we've been told, well, these people know more than you do. But this is when it comes back to that whole reality of, but how does it feel? And oftentimes as women, we're not encouraged to go with how something feels. In fact, we've been told that we're too emotional because we're not using logic. These are patriarchal constructs. Because in fact, the feeling, the going into the body, recognizing what the body is saying, allowing our intuition to move forward. These things matter. And that's how you know during childbirth, or this doesn't feel quite right. Your body knows, but we're taught to second guess ourselves and to keep everything in the mind. And so I love that when we're no longer focusing on this person knows more than I do. I know myself. I can feel it in myself that what's happening can be changed and we can do better. So for the fact that so many mothers, so many people are getting together and saying something needs to change. Let's swap notes. Let's look at where we are. Let's look at what we can demand in terms of policies changing. Let's share our experiences so we know that we are not alone. So we know that we're not forgotten. We haven't forgotten each other. And that's what's important for me about the conference. It's a way for us to see each other and not forget each other, know that we haven't been forgotten, and therefore we can move together collectively with the power, with the one voice, to demand change, because the change is possible and it's only due to kind of deeply entrenched patriarchal perspectives that make us think that, oh, you know, nothing can be done about this. We don't know why these disparities are taking place in terms of maternal mortality rates. Everything can be changed. We just have to want to change it.
100%. And actually, a lot of what you're describing is, I chose to give birth at home to step outside of that. I can't imagine it as a Black mother, how hard it must be navigating that system. What was your experience of the UK health system as a pregnant and then birthing mother?
Horrendous, I would say, in certain regards. And I think this is also the importance of showing visible support to the Black Maternal Health Conference, as well as, you know, all of the other work that's going on. Because I remember when I had my first pregnancy, I remember I was in the middle of teaching a class, or I was about to teach a class. I kept feeling like twinges. I was about to teach a twerk class. And then before I knew it, you know, I just couldn't. I was like doubled over. I just couldn't. And luckily, there was a lady that had come to take part in a twerk class, one of my avid twerkers. She happened to be a paramedic. And so it was in the Uber that I just started like bleeding profusely. And I remember that day I was wearing like camo shorts, like, yeah, these camouflage shorts, and just bled all the way through. Got out of the Uber. Even then, I was really apologetic and I was really stressed out as well, because I had a hen party to teach that afternoon. And I was just, I remember texting them while bleeding profusely, texting them and being like, I'm so sorry, I won't be able to teach your class, but I'll figure out a refund. And I'm just doing all of these things while doing that. So when I think about what it means for me to be here, to be at the point where I have to say, no, work cannot, you know, be prioritized over what my body's physically doing right now. And I remember we got to the A&E, and this white man, and I was with a white woman, and that's really important, a white blonde woman. This white man saw me and he went, no, you've come through the wrong entrance, like covered in blood, drenched in blood, right? Dripping. It's just following me, a trail at this point. He just looks at me and goes, no, you've come through the wrong entrance. You need to go through the main one. And she was like, no. We're coming through this one. I'm a paramedic and I've brought her through this one because this is where we'd come through if I was in an ambulance. And so she's coming through with me. That, to me, if anybody ever wants to speak to me about allyship, that was the moment. And she saw it in real time, that, wait, so this is what Black women go through. Like, you are just, like, my lower half was just, you know, it was a horror scene. And yet he could still look at me and not be bothered and go, no, you're using bureaucracy in this moment instead of thinking, what is going on? Why is she bleeding this much? You know, bless her, the lady that came with me, she was just like, no, she needs to be seen. And he was like, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, sure. And I was taken into a room. And then that whole process started. And the person who came in was very much like, yeah, so I could only, exactly this tone. Yeah, so from seeing this amount of blood, what I would say is that you've probably already lost the baby. So, I mean, we'll get checked. We'll get you checked out. But, you know, ultrasounds, I don't think we'll be able to do it until Monday, because this was Sunday. She's like, so we'll have to sort it out then. The whole process was very, very cold. I remember being upstairs in the ward at this point, very distraught. I'd been taken to a room and the nurse came in, I was in a lot of pain, and she said, oh, well, you know, have this, I think it was Cocodamol. She was like, have this painkiller and, you know, it should help, you know, to just kind of alleviate some of the pain. So just have this. And then she left the door ajar. And then I heard her on the phone and she was just like, yeah, I've given her Cocodamol, but it's not going to work. So yeah. She's like, but it's not going to work. So will somebody be coming round soon to see if they can give her something stronger? What's her name? She says my name. Okay, well, let me know. So I ended up writing a letter, to, you know, making a complaint to the hospital. I said at every single stage, I feel like race played a part in why I received such abysmal care. And I got a letter back from the head of women's health or whatever at that hospital. And she said, yep, you know, each item, because I itemized everything. I was just like, and this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. For each thing, she said, I'm so sorry that that happened. That shouldn't have happened. We should have done better. I'm so sorry that happened. Over and over and over again. Then we got to the bottom of the letter. And she said, when I asked the staff whether this happened as because of your race, they all said no. So I'm disappointed that you would think that this had anything to do with race, but we do need to do better in the future. And I was just stunned. I was just like, so you think that you would just ask somebody and they would go, yeah, sure, I did it because she's black? No, because it's so deeply embedded in our psyche that the first guy that I interacted with probably wouldn't know why he did that and instantly responded to the white woman that I was with and said, oh, of course, sure. So if I can lend my voice and my experiences to such a conference, as in the Black Maternal Health Conference, then absolutely I will, because I know that similar things have happened to other black women. And they just didn't have my platform or my quote unquote clout to be able to call it out. And if we don't say anything, then I don't think things will change. Saying all of that, even though my experience, my birthing experience regarding my son, that was shambolic as well. I do remember that luckily the midwives that ended up being there for me in that actual moment of him entering the world were brilliant, like just absolutely brilliant, phenomenal. And I think it was last year, I went to a party and my friend who I was with introduced me to this woman. He was like, oh, this is my auntie. I said, oh, nice to meet you. She says, what's your name? I said, Kelechi. Kelechi, that's a beautiful name. I've heard it before. Where have I? Do you know this woman? She's online and she's got like, you know, she has a pole dance studio. and she says, I was like, that's me. She said, no, no, because then if that's you, then I helped give birth to your son. It's like, what? And she's like, yeah, you know, there's just some people that you don't forget. And I've, you know, helped to give birth to lots of babies, but there was just something about you I couldn't forget. Like, and then I remember going into the office and someone saying, do you know whose baby you're delivering? That's Kelechi. And she's like, I didn't know who you were at that point, but I just remember thinking that I really liked your energy. And that really stayed with me.
Absolutely. Wow, that's such a beautiful story. Oh my gosh. Did you just talk to her all night?
All night. I just kept saying, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Just, I was like, thank you.
Were you like getting your phone out, showing the pictures of him? Oh,
she was, so... Yeah. She was, I just kept saying, thank you so much. Thank you so much. She's like, how is he doing? And again, like you said, I was just like showing her the photo. She's like, oh, he's beautiful. He's wonderful. And so that felt like a beautiful sort of rounding off of that experience that, you know, started when I think about the first pregnancy, you know, abysmally, and then to then randomly go to a party and meet this woman. And she happened to be somebody who was with me in that, you know, fantastic, like otherworldly experience.
That's so beautiful. That is so beautiful. Tell me about your new storybook, Strong Like Me.
Strong Like Me. I just feel like it's something that needed to be written. There are so many young girls out there who are scared of being strong. Again, because it's that other thing that we're taught that girls aren't strong, you know, but then later on we're praised for the other type of strength, which is the one that we've put ourselves on the shelf and we're just available for everybody else, right? All enduring, that martyrdom thing that we were speaking about as well. the all-enduring, never-complaining sort of woman that we're encouraged to grow up to be. And Strong Like Me is a celebration of physical strength. I remember growing up being fast and being all of these things and being told, oh, but boys aren't going to like you when you're really strong, because then what do? Girl, I don't know. Get strong as well. I don't know. Or just be who you are, right? These are the skills that I have and I want to use them. And statistically speaking, a lot of girls tend to drop out of sports by the age, by the age of 15. And then later on, they're missing this thing. They don't know what it is. They don't know what that feeling is, but it's because maybe there was something that they were really good at sports wise, but then your body's changing, you're becoming, you know, really noticed. And so you just want to hide away, right? And so Strong Like Me is a celebration of strength in all of its forms, not just the physical. And Kamara is that girl. And Kamara was the name that I actually chose for the character, because when I was first pregnant, I thought I'd be having a girl. And I thought, if I have a girl, I'm going to name her Kamara. And so when all of that experience happened, I feel like Kamara gets to kind of live on and be out there in the world in this way.
Honestly, it sounds incredible. And I always ask the same question at the end, which is, if you could give just one gift to all the mothers in the world, what would that one gift be and why?
I would gift all the mothers in the world the freedom to play. We take our children to the soft play and we watch them play in the garden or play around the home. And we understand that it's important for children, but we don't understand that it's important for ourselves. Life forces us to take ourselves so seriously, but we need space for play, not just like out with the girls drinking wine. I mean, play. I mean, get some paint on your body or roll around a bit, you know, or be out in a garden, go and jump in some puddles. Why not? Yes, maybe someone looks at you and like, oh, she's lost it. Play is so important because it is the pathway to curiosity, and curiosity is the pathway to liberation. So if we want to get liberated, we have to begin with play.
I've just absolutely loved this conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the wise words. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
This episode is sponsored by Tea India. If you know me, you will know I am obsessed with tea. So I'm really excited to tell you about Tea India, especially their chai. I absolutely love chai. It's a blend of cinnamon, cloves, ginger, cardamom, and each cup of Tea India's chai is just so comforting. There's no additives, no compromises, just real tea and real spices, keeping it simple and satisfying. I'm also excited to tell you about the all new decaf masala chai. It's everything you love about masala chai, minus the caffeine kick. So if you're pregnant or for any reason you don't want caffeine, this is the drink for you, especially if you are craving a deliciously warm decaf cuppa that does not compromise on taste. You can find Tea India in all supermarkets nationwide, and their decaf masala chai in Waitrose. You can also purchase Tea India on their website, teaindia.co.uk, and use my exclusive discount code MOTHERKIND10 for 10% off your first order.